Right, good morning. Most of you know me. My name's John Arthur. If you don't know me, my name's John Arthur. Hello. If you hear Dominic at the back, hi Dominic, he's smiling but now ignoring me. Dominic's my friend, and if he's making a lot of noise during the service, that's because that's where Dominic is at the moment in his life of disability. I hope it doesn't disturb you. I'm going to try and let it not disturb me, but it is what it is, and I love Dominic, so I have to kind of cope with who he is to me now. We're going to look at this passage. Thanks, Pete, for giving me this passage. I can't imagine a passage more difficult to preach on, to be perfectly honest. When the evening came, so this is after the feeding of the 5,000. This is after that's all happened, and Jesus has gone off up a hill, because he was on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, which is about 5 miles wide and 8 miles long. And the disciples don't really know what they're supposed to do because Jesus is kind of gone. When the evening came, his disciples went down to the lake and there was a boat there. And they're going, right, boat, fishermen, hungry, desolate place, no food. Touchwood is just across the lake. Let's get some pizza. I think that's really what was happening here. So they got in the boat. By now it was dark, but they don't care about that because they're fishermen and they fish in the dark. And they have fished most of their young lives on this very lake in the dark, so they know what they're doing. It's not a worry. And Jesus had not yet joined them. And it's a wonder whether he is going to. There is nothing clear in the text that suggests that he will. He's gone off, which must be slightly disquieting for them. So they decide to play to form. We're fishermen. Here's a boat. I know what to do. Let's go and get some food. And a strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough, but that didn't bother them too much. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, says John, who understands the number of stadia it's possible to row. What is he, Olympic rowing coach or something? He works out how many strokes that was, and he knows how far it is. Well, he's a fisherman, and he fished this lake, and he knows how wide it is. And so he says, when we've rowed about, you know, a handful of stadia, so we're about halfway across on the way to Capernaum, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water. You've got to stop. You've got to stop at that point. They saw the guy they knew defying gravity. If I was to just fly now, if I was just to fly up the ceiling and float around and come back down, I would not expect you to treat me the same. Because I can fly and you can't. I would expect that to be disquieting. So they saw him walking on the water. And they were terrified. Too right, they were terrified. What on earth is going on? But he said to them, it is I. Don't be afraid. What he should have said is, it is still me. Don't be afraid. And then they were willing to take him into the boat. Yeah, right, I'm sure they were. I'm sure that there was a bit of conversation first before they decided whether to take this apparition into the boat with them. But they did take him into the boat. And then things got very interesting because then the boat immediately reached the shore that it had actually been 1.5 miles from at this very point. And then the crowd turns up and all sorts of other stuff and the things keep going. That's the passage that we're going to look at, okay? So I might just leave that there. I'll hold my notes up. On the face of it, this is one of the plainest miracles that you have in the scriptures. Jesus, our disciples are in a boat. He walks on the water. They go, ah! He goes, nah. And they go, okay. And then we're here. That's kind of how it seems to work. There are a couple of obvious critical challenges here. One of them is, do you believe this story? I mean, Jesus does do many things like this in the Gospels. Do you believe this story? Do you believe that Jesus Christ of Nazareth was capable of walking on water? And then, if you do believe it, what can it mean? What did it mean then? And what can it mean now that this Jesus character does these things? Well, if we are believing, I'm assuming that, I won't ask for a show of hands, but I am assuming that you believe that this is a true story of Jesus and that he actually did do this. And so there are sort of four definite things that come out of that. One is dead obvious. Jesus is a reverser of the ordinary. Jesus reverses your ordinary. The other is that Jesus has a purpose which is not the same as that of his followers. We'll unpack that. More particularly and perhaps more worryingly, we have a Jesus presented to us here who is looking for participants in a mission, the credentials of which are discomforting and are not of the earth. And we have a Jesus in this story who wants to challenge the validity of a journey that is being made without him. This is the most interesting thing about this miracle in terms of things we could say about it is where it is. It's at a pivotal point in the story of Jesus. It's at the crossover moment. There is a crossover moment in John's gospel. We've got to John 6. And up until John 6, it's all been Jesus turns water into wine. Yay! Lots of wine, actually, quite a great deal of wine. Somebody made a ton of money off of that because there was an awful lot left by the time that rather drunken wedding was finished. Jesus heals people. Hooray! Jesus feeds 5,000 people who didn't even ask for dinner. And marvelous magic. And everybody's going, who is this? Who is this? This is really great. The next 6 chapters are not going to be so comfortable. So this is a fulcrum moment. And whatever Jesus is trying to do, By defying gravity and walking on water and behaving like a superhero for his disciples who are privy to this, it is clearly some way in which he wants to prepare them for what is to come ahead. So let's take a look. Who are the disciples in the story? Who is Jesus in the story? Jesus has been, as we've been studying, progressively revealed to his disciples, but he's been doing so, as Jesus always does, with an increasing level of challenge. We've got a ratchet Jesus. You know what ratchet means? It's one of those little things that you use to tighten bolts that you don't have to put it on the bolt back up. It goes and then back to the start. And it always makes things tighter. We've got a Jesus like that. He always makes things tighter. Once he's put a bit of torque in your life, that doesn't go away, but then he goes back to the top and he puts a bit more in. He has been increasing the challenge. So when he does his healings, he's being extremely poignant. He heals a royal official's son. Okay, that's a son in the household of Herod, who is the illegitimate king who is sitting on the throne that belongs to Jesus. And that son is going to die. And Jesus, in an ironic twist of grace, says, that son of that royal household shall not die. Dot, dot, dot. It's very poignant for those who have ears. When Jesus heals the man at the pool, we know, you heard, I think, last week or the week before, here is a representative of Israel. Israel is sick. Israel's not well. Israel is paralyzed. Israel has given up any hope that she has of God other than that God comes and does it all. And so God turns up and says, I'm not going to do it all. Pick up your mat and walk. And by the way, when I meet you later, you might have to realize that there is some sin to be reconciled out of all this, or something very much worse is going to happen to you. That's quite a poignant healing. That's not just uncomplicated. Jesus demonstrates what I call extreme inclusion. The wedding at Cana in Galilee, his first big sign in John's gospel, the first big miracle of Jesus. We're at a wedding where we don't meet the bride and we don't meet the groom. Instead, we're presented with Jesus, who seems to be sitting center table and whose mother is there saying they've not got enough wine. And Jesus does something peculiar, and suddenly there is an abundance of wine. There's 1,000 bottles worth of wine suddenly lands on this wedding. And that is evocative of the prophecies that when the Messiah comes, a new wine will drip from the hills and it will be there in abundance. That is evocative of God's inclusion of Israel. Israel is there in her bridal state. She is ready to be married. And who has come? Who has come to celebrate that with her? The groom himself, the groom, capital G, has come. And all Israel is included in that miracle, and everybody can see it. It's very extreme. And then we get to the feeding of the 5,000, which is the thing that happens just before Jesus walks on the water here. And that is extreme as well. No one was expecting this sort of a feeding. And Jesus turns it into this enormous spectacle of community, getting people to sit down in roughly church-sized groups and feeds them the bread that they were not expecting. And there's a piquancy to this bread, because after he walks on water and when he gets to the other side, he's going to preach a sermon about this bread that will drive most of them away. This is a tipping point. Jesus has been progressively and increasingly challenging his disciples. He's on a mission. They're starting to get it. They are starting to wake up to the idea that he's on a mission. And so there is a trajectory of relationship with him that they must find in the middle of this mission. They can't just be carrying on going, yay, Jesus. There is something poignant that is going to happen to them. There is something that is going to happen to their being if they continue to hang around with this guy who, let's face it, is getting a bit scary. And then what does he do? He turns up walking on water. And totally, totally terrifies them. He came at them through their doubt. He came at them through their confusion. They kind of stuck with it. They got that. They got a handle of it. And then he says, okay, time for step 3, ladies and gentlemen. I'm now going to approach you through your fear. and they're expected to take that. Jesus approaches us through our fear at him, through our incomprehension of who he is, and through the challenge of the supernaturality of what his mission is and how it will be empowered. And there are no questions. The only question is, do you accept me in this, says Jesus. It's a tipping point. It's a kingdom tipping point. They see a visceral Jesus in this story because they've got nothing to go on. John's gospel doesn't have Jesus calming the storm. They don't know that he commands the wind and the waves. They've got no idea about that. And this miracle does not evoke any messianic prophecy or any scriptural footing. There is nothing in Joel or Obadiah or anything that says when the Messiah comes, he's going to defy gravity. There's nothing in Lamentations or Isaiah or anything that says you'll know him by the way he walks on water. None of that's going on. This is a class A distinct miracle that breaks the cycle of the scriptures and says, I am utterly unique compared to them. I am something different compared to them. Of course I fulfill them. I overwhelm them just as I am overwhelming you now. Be overwhelmed. Don't accept that I am predicted to be something through what you have read. That's a tough challenge. That's not easy for them to take. It's a tipping point. Look at me and look at me conferring onto myself supernatural credentials. This is a supernatural gig that you've got yourself into. So be very afraid. Which indeed they were. The quintessence of this miracle. We're studying the signs in John, the signs that show Jesus' kingdom. The thing is, John doesn't call this one a sign, and I don't think this one is a sign, because all of the others are done in public. The wedding before Israel, the feeding of the 5,000, including the Jews and the Gentiles together in a big sort of mashup. They're healing at the pool when everybody's there and it's all happening. There's big crowds following Jesus. Feeding of the 5,000 when there must be at least 10,000 people there. Jesus does his big sign things. And then we get this at night in the middle of a storm, a couple of disciples sitting in a boat, nobody else around, no one to witness this. And Jesus does the most spectacular thing he has yet done. Apart from being born, perhaps. But you know what I mean. The most spectacular thing he's yet done. And he does it in private, to a very small group of special people that he has selected. Whatever this is, it's something very visceral to them that he is doing. He has journeyed supernaturally into the middle of their journey, and he wants to say something to them because of that. What is it? Well, as a minimum, it has to be, look at me, I reverse your ordinary. What do we learn from how this story plays out? Of the disciples, we don't learn much, because there isn't much text to tell us. They were, basically, we can read them as playing to form. So when Jesus isn't around, the disciples just say, well, here's a boat, and there's a town, and we might as well go. And so they look for the ordinary, they look for the conventional, and they use the skills that they have to hand. They just do what they're good at. And that is the thing that Jesus interrupts with this spectacular notion. And we can see a Jesus who, counter to our understanding of gentle Jesus, meek and mild, counter to our understanding of his holy presence and all that sort of stuff, we can see a Jesus who wants to use his absence as powerfully as he wants to use his presence. We can see a Jesus who is not there and wants to say something by not being there. Because after the feeding of the 5,000, I don't really know what's on Jesus' mind. He has just had an epidemic of church growth. What is the man doing? Why is he not arranging them into groups? Why is he not building missions? Why is he not doing all the stuff? He has recruited the number that he needs. What is going on? Why has he taken himself off when he really needs to be at the front leading the whole thing? Well, John says, and I take him at his word when he does, Jesus absented himself at this point because he knew these people were ready for the kingdom. He knew they were ready for the kingdom. The kingdom that he was bringing was not the one that they were ready for. And so he absented himself because he understood that they would come and try and force him into the mold that they had for him. John says they intended to come and make him king by force. And so Jesus sneaks off up a hill, so they can't do that. And without him there, they kind of disperse and think about it in another way. These people were out to use Jesus for their own ends.
These people were out to use a Jesus that they could shape into their own expectation, and he will have none of that. And so when it looks like it's happening, he makes himself absent because he has reached the tipping point. He's got them ready for the kingdom. It's just that he's not quite landed the killer message, which is that the kingdom they're ready for is not the one that God is giving. So he takes himself away. I would argue that he also takes himself away to prepare himself for the sifting and the testing and the opposition which he is about to face. Because if you read John's Gospel, the first six chapters are pretty cool, but the next whole six chapters, the next 294 verses, is an unrelenting stream of opposition and controversy and stuff that leads to Jesus' death. It takes 294 verses before something nice happens to the man again. He knew that was on the cards. And he went to be with his father in order to prepare himself, we assume, for the sifting and the testing that was going to bring him. Why the walking on the water thing? Why? You know, the disciples are at the halfway point, and then you either get this natural or this supernatural thing, and you have to sort out what you think it is. So there's an argument that says, actually, because of the wind and the waves, they were a bit further on than they thought they were. And actually, what Jesus did was he saw that they were coming and they were a bit troubled, so he waded out into the water. And he was actually standing on a sandbar, but because they believed themselves to be in the middle of the lake, they turned around and went, "Whoa!" And actually, it was all just totally normal. And the reason that the boat arrived where it was going was because it was already there. That's a rational explanation for what we see. But then there is the supernatural explanation. The reason John says, no, we were in the middle of the lake. Let me tell you, we were in the middle of the lake. I don't care how quickly we got there. We were in the middle of the lake when this happened. And the challenge and the decision that comes from Jesus comes in the middle, comes at the tipping point in terms of what they're trying to do. And he says to them, don't be afraid. Because they were petrified. It's me. It's still me. I've just got a whole lot bigger. I know I've just blown your mind. However, it is still me. But it is a fuller version of me, the version that you will need if you're going to come with me. And so they were challenged with the decision, can I get into the boat? And they have to make up their mind what they're going to do. I suspect that there were a few conversations going on in that boat. I suspect their personalities were coming through as they debated whether to take this water walking Jesus in. And when the consensus was, yes, we will, and he gets in, I can see that Jesus would feel their eyes burning through the back of his head as they all look at him. And he has to say, it's okay, guys, it really is still me. And by the way, just to stop all this nonsense, we're there. And the miracle is that they discovered that they immediately arrived where they were going. What is going on? The bigger miracle here is not that Jesus walks on water, it's that Jesus transports a boat, at least 12 people and himself, across 1.5 miles of space and time in an instant. That's much more disturbing than him walking on the water. The implication is clear. We've come to the tipping point in our relationship, says Jesus. When I turned the water into wine, you were my initiates. You were there and you were kind of chuffed by it, and you could see that it was kind of groovy and interesting what I was doing. When I healed all those people that you saw me healing and you understood the big Israeli backstory behind that healing, you were pretty much observers. When I fed the 5,000, I decided I'd had enough of that, and so I put you in the role of helpers. I cast you as those of Israel who would take the bread and give it to their dogs. And I didn't learn that lesson very well when you set up the church, I noticed. But anyway, now comes the point when Jesus says, are we going to be accomplices? I don't want initiates. I don't want observers. I don't even want helpers. I want initiates. I want the word that has gone out of my head. I want accomplices. I want people who will be swept up in what I am doing. You need to become a part of it. So they are not allowed to see this miracle. Because they take him into the boat, they have to take a part in it. And it's a very scary part because wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Suddenly we've moved 1.5 miles through time and space and we don't understand how we've done that. And Jesus is getting out of the boat saying, well, let's go and have something to eat. And we're all like, whoa, Jesus, too many questions. There are too many questions about what has just happened. And Jesus is like, we're busy. We're on our way somewhere. Let's get going. You just have to deal with that the way it is. Jesus comes seeking participants in a mission, the credentials of which are not comforting, and they are not of the earth. Does the church want this Jesus? Does the church want a visceral Jesus who comes at us through our fear? The story challenges us, as with the crowd. He confronts us to leave behind believing in a Jesus who can feed us as the only thing that's on offer, and accepting a Jesus who wants to take you on an adventure past the tipping point of his kingdom, and it's going to be a kingdom of risk that you're being taken into, and are you up for it? And yes, by the way, I have the supernatural credentials to be able to deliver it. As with the disciples, he has not sent the church on ahead to wait for him. They've done that at their initiative. He hasn't done that. And so he meets them powerfully in the middle of their here and their now and their who and their where, and he gives them a Jesus that they were not ready for and that they cannot cope with. And then he says, will you take me into what you are doing? Right now, right here. And they have to make up their mind what they're going to do. Maybe especially for church, the challenge of Jesus in this passage is a challenge to the validity of a journey that you might be making without him. And he doesn't want to take that. So let's draw this to a conclusion. What does this mean for me? Well, if I am a Christian, the Jesus who comes to me in this story asks me, will I let him reverse my ordinary? Will what is ordinary to me become turned over for him? So we who go to work, we who have bosses that we do or do not like, we who have colleagues that we do or do not get on with, to what degree do we passionately pray into their lives? To what degree do we ask our Lord, however uncomfortable we might be with it, to make us someone of grace in that situation and then take what comes with that? Are we as individual Christians accepting a Jesus who wants us to be subservient to his purpose, not allowing his purpose to affect our own? These are different. Do you see yourself as subservient to Jesus rather than helped by him? Because they are different. They are not the same thing. Do you make an offering out of your life? It doesn't have to be every day. But do you sit on the edge of your bed and you say, I'm going into my day, Lord, and I long to extend your kingdom in that day. And so I invite you to offer me an experience where that will happen. And I promise you, I will be faithful when it comes. Do you let Jesus reverse the ordinary things of your life and see him in the waves and the wind of what you're doing? Are you becoming subservient to his purpose, not your own? And as a church, the challenge that comes to us through this particular passage is that Jesus has cancelled a number of roles that we are very comfortable with. So Jesus in this passage cancels the role of the observer. It's not all right to see if you like it. That isn't really gonna work. Jesus has cancelled the role of the helper, someone who takes a little bit of something for themselves because they're helping God. That's gone as well. Jesus is looking for accomplices. He's looking for people who will be part of something. And the something that he wants us to be part of is not a church. The something that he wants us to be part of is not a saving personal faith in some heavenly being who I might go and meet when I die. It's not something odd or weird, other than he wants to occupy your life. And it's a radical occupation that means that every aspect of it will come to serve in a supernatural way the kingdom of God expressed through you. You have become a touch point of heaven in the world because of your ownership of Jesus. And that has to be effective or it has to be not. Jesus says, I don't need you to see. I don't need you to want to, I don't need you to want. I don't need you to plead with me. I need this to be effective. It has to be as an accomplice of mine that you go into the world. As a church, do we accept the toughest challenge of this passage, which is the fact that we have a supernatural God? Do we accept a supernatural Jesus who wants to challenge the validity of our journey? When Jesus turns up, will we invite him into the boat? Will he come in with us? And the way that we could do that as a church is that we could stop being conservative. We could tackle the embarrassment that we feel about the work of the Holy Spirit. We could tackle those Sunday lunch conversations between the haves and the have-nots. The people who are muttering around their Sunday dinner about somebody who tried to speak in tongues, or somebody who tried to have a word from God and kind of stumbled and got it wrong. Somebody who saw a vision that did nothing for me, quite frankly. And on the other side, the people who are ulcerating for everyone else to join them and angry with them that no one else seems to want the Spirit. We could tackle the embarrassment of that division amongst us and agree that we are not going to be conservative any longer, because Jesus walks on water. Doesn't he give you a hug? Who have you as a church? Who have we as a community? Who have I invited into the boat? Is it a man who can do wonders with the help of God? Or is it God himself who defies the natural order because he is God? One of them is very safe. One of them will keep his power to himself. One of them will be all right for you to believe in. The other is very dangerous for your life, because he gifts his power to his kingdom makers like you and wants to believe in you. You can be forever in awe of one of them. The other one wants to push you past the tipping point so that the kingdom that he has in mind is the one that you're willing to bring, and you bring it with a credential which is supernatural. Let me conclude with a story. It's a real story. It happened in my life. It's kind of one of these things that people do. It's a killer story. It's a good story. I don't want you to think these sorts of things happen to me all the time, but they do happen to me now and then. And I want to encourage you in all of that stuff, that irrespective of how fearful we might be of a supernatural Jesus, we're in safe hands. We're absolutely in safe hands if we take him into the boat. I was recently in Kenya. The elections for the government in Kenya are on Monday. Last time those elections came about, there was such civil unrest and such violence. A great many people who worked for my company were put in danger, and some of them even died. And so I was there in order to help my company better prepare so that would not happen this time. I felt very righteous. I felt really, really strong in myself that I was giving my skills directly to God. It was great. And I gave myself another day in the country when I could stay there and see, and they'd booked me a driver, and I had a day in Nairobi City before I came home. I woke up quite early in the morning, did all the things, you know, showered and packed my bag and did all that sort of stuff. And then I thought, here's a day unto God. After all I've just been doing, here's a day unto God. So I sat on the edge of my bed and I said the very thing I encourage you to say. I said, God, just today, I would like to be someone who extends your kingdom. If you give me an opportunity to do that, I will be faithful. And then we headed off. I reckon my cards were kind of stacked anyway, because I had a driver, someone from the country. He was there for my safety as well as my transportation. So I reckon my cards were stacked, because he was going to have to sit in the car all day with me. And if you're all day with me, then I'm afraid Jesus is going to come up. It wasn't the driver. I was taken to the Museum of Kenya, and I paid my ticket to go in. And, this is Africa, so it's not quite how you would imagine it in Birmingham. So I was taken to this museum, and I was introduced to a young lady called Ellen. And Ellen's job was to take me around the museum. I was having a personal tour guide who was going to tell me about the history of Kenya, show me all the exhibits, and she was trained. She was a student of tourism, and she was doing an internment in the museum. Not the internment that you'd put you under the ground, obviously. So Ellen and I walked around this museum together for about 2 hours, and during that time, we spoke of many things. She was very interesting. I like to think so am I. So we compared the Scottish and the African tribal system, such as it was, and compared and contrasted what was going on there. We spoke about the transformative power of education in Africa, and I told her about two lovely people that I know called Sarah and Hannah Jackson, and what they'd been doing in their passion for Africa and for the education of its children. We talked about the impact of David Livingstone, and we talked about Pastor John of Blantyre, if you saw that television program. I won't go into it if you didn't. But we just You see what I was doing? I was pushing it in the direction of talking about my life in church, my life as a member of the Christian community. We talked about how love and marriage function in the UK and how they are different in Africa. And we talked, and she spoke quite openly in a way that I was very moved by, about her rejection by her family tribe that she belonged to. This was a tribe, she told me quite openly and without any embarrassment, that practices female circumcision. So if a rite of passage for a young woman to get married is that she must be circumcised. For those who understand that, that is a mutilation that will disfigure them for life. And she told me that she was not going to do that, which meant that she could never marry in her tribe and that she would always be rejected by them for this failure to comply with what the culture wanted. She told me about times when she goes home and how she gets in trouble for the way that she is dressed, because now she's dressing as a city girl and she's not wearing her tribal costume and people think she's putting on airs and graces rather than just found a new wardrobe. She told me that because she is becoming educated, her long-term boyfriend has done away with her because he's only a farmer. And African men do not like their women to be more clever than them, and they don't like their women to have a higher earning potential than them. So he contrived the reason and he told her that their relationship was now over because of the choices that she had made. And so it went on. And I appreciated that I was in a divine moment, that I was in a place that I had asked for earlier that day. I appreciated that I had been put together, one being with another being, because Jesus Christ within me was calling out to her life, and I so wanted to be faithful to that. I so wanted to be true to that, and the only thing I needed was a mechanism by which I could do that. And sure, I was talking about my faith and stuff, but I'd do that anyway. But I needed that connection to be a supernatural connection that Jesus himself had caused. So we're walking through the art gallery section and Ellen turns to me, she says, "Do you like art?" And I said, "Well, I'm not very good artistically, I suppose. I don't own any art. I certainly don't produce any art. Other than the fact that I write poetry from time to time. And of course, I'm a preacher. I'm someone who speaks in the church." And Ellen fixed my gaze and she says, "You're a preacher in the church, are you? Perhaps at the end of our tour, you could preach for me." So, here we are. I had 15 minutes to get my sermon ready, and I knew it had to be a short one, and those who know me maybe don't think that's actually physically possible for me. I reached out to God. What will I tell her? My text was the Magnificat. My person was Mary. Someone who has to reject her culture. Someone who is seen as an outcast because of what has happened to her. Someone who has to accept what others perceive as a curse and bear it nonetheless. And someone who rises to a height of militancy in her God because of what God has done for her and because she rejects the ordinary. She overturns that and says, "I will be who God has made and I will be called blessed because of this curse." And I said to Ellen, "Mary has to be your firebrand in your life because you have chosen the path of Mary. And please know, God is delighted with you." There is no secret to this. You have to remember to invite Jesus into the boat and make sure it's the right one that comes in. I was painfully aware when I left that museum, Jesus had reversed what was very ordinary and made it to be of something that was him. That Jesus had a purpose for Ellen and he used me as an instrument because I was willing to be an instrument. That what happened between me and Ellen was not of the earth. It was supernatural, where God was breaking through into her life. And that God had seen fit to take my journey, which was being made without him, and allow it to be about him. Church of God, this is all we're looking for. This is all we're looking for from you. If you accept a Jesus who walks on water, let him reverse what is ordinary here. If you accept a Jesus who walks on water, align what you do with his purpose. Don't bring him an offering. If you accept a Jesus who walks on water, stop pursuing the things of the earth. If you accept a Jesus who walks on water, be very careful that the journey that you have taken these 70 years is not your own journey. Because he might need to interrupt it, and the way that he interrupts it might be to bring a supernatural element into it that will unleash His kingdom and His mission. And the question that He asks you in the middle of that is, are you ready to tip over into My kingdom? Will you take Me into your boat? And the answer hangs in the air. Amen.